Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we have another two-hour zero-point radio session, thanks to BBS Radio. Through these talks and discussions, we explore mystical and scientific concepts of human consciousness and mystical and scientific views about creation and physics and metaphysics and so on. I'm a PhD clinical and forensic psychology, and I work under the logo Zero Point, which is related to Blavatsky's secret doctrine, wherein she suggests that all living beings have zero point centers, by which is meant it's as if we have a monad, a monadic essence, or a God spark, or a Jiva Atma, or a divine spark within the human being. These are different terms that might be used to describe the same concept. Blavatsky talks of the monad, whereas Shirley MacLaine in Going Within says the basic idea in the New Age is that we all have a God spark within us. Well, 30 years ago, I became interested. Wow, what would that mean if we really had a God spark within us? How is that conceivable that something like that might be true? Is that possible? And I began 30 years ago to try to understand that possibility. And that has led me into a wide study of mystical teachings as well as modern scientific ideas about physics and creation science. So the idea is that we all have a zero point element by which I mean an element so small that it's beyond the material level of perception. See, a divine spark isn't something which has extension within four-dimensional space-time. Okay, it is something that exists beyond the created four-dimensional space-time complex. Okay, it is beyond the level of our perception. In a way, I would say that this zero-point center exists within seven-dimensional hyperspace. That there's a little element and it exists in this hyperspace which underlies and sustains the four-dimensional space-time complex that we perceive. So in a way there's four large dimensions and then there's an underlying seven-dimensional hyperspace. And that the phenomena produced that are manifest to our senses are really produced out of the dynamics occurring within this higher dimensional hyperspace. So there's different ways I try to explain the concept of zero point centers. This is a very subtle and complex idea to understand. And an interest in zero point dynamics has now emerged in modern physics. Now Blavatsky talked about it in 1888, saying that human beings had these dynamic zero point centers. Okay. But in the quantum physics of the last 10 years, the most important concept to emerge is that concerns what's called zero point energies and zero point fields. Because the new idea understanding of space or of what's called the quantum vacuum is that the vacuum isn't really empty. What seems to be empty space to us, if you go down into the nature of space, to zero point levels, which the zero point level is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That's the zero point level is determined by the uncertainty principle in modern physics. But in quantum physics, if you try to go into the nature of empty space, you find that zero point levels, instead of space being empty and void, instead, there's a huge amount of energy and potential and electromagnetic radiation. So it's like there's this sea of underlying or unifying light which underlies and sustains all manifest phenomena. So in physics, the idea is that there are these zero-point fields. And you may have heard the idea of people talking about free energy technologies. Well, one of the ideas of this is that if we could tap some of this energy latent within space itself, then there's a huge amount of energy latent in space, and we somehow simply have to extract it out of empty space. About a year or so ago, I had a call from a fellow who said at the time he was putting on a conference where they were going to introduce a zero-point energy device that you could, for instance, have one in your kitchen, and this zero-point energy device, you could plug all your appliances and stove and everything into it, and it would simply draw energy out of the empty space. So it would be like free energy. You wouldn't have any external lines or batteries or electrical connections. Instead, this device would simply draw somehow this energy out of empty space. So that would be described as drawing these energies out of the zero-point field energies. So that's a bit of the idea in modern physics. What's unusual about Blavatsky's work, what is in Blavatsky's work in The Secret Doctrine, published in 1888, that's not in modern physics, is the concept that human beings actually have a zero-point energy. And we ourselves, in a way, are zero-point energy devices. We operate on these same principles, and we have a zero-point center. And the way I explain it and trying to understand it is that this zero-point center, this is the origin of the I experience. Like the I am experience is this zero point center. It is the kind of unitary I within the human being. In science, we see the scientists think that human consciousness is produced by all the different neurological activity and biological activity, and all these molecules or cells somehow produce or generate consciousness and the experience of self. But in science, no one thinks seriously that a human being might have a singular I, like a thing which is unitary. Instead, as Francis Crick says, we are nothing but a pack of neurons. So he sees consciousness is produced by all these different neurons, and the experience of I, he thinks, is produced by all these different neurons. So the idea of there being a singular I is only an illusion. It's only an illusion produced, whereas really there is no singular I. Modern scientists don't consider a human being as possibly having a singular I. And mainly scientists, when they try to identify where your I or your sense of self is, they assume that experience is produced by the brain and it's centered in the head. The newest ideas identify parts of the frontal cortex as producing the social experience and awareness of self. Okay. Whereas the mystical teachings, our zero point center and the monad are associated not with the brain in the head, but are associated with the heart. And the mystical teachings, self-realization involves the awakening and opening of the heart. So I taught my most important book is called The Heart Doctrine, which I contrast with the head doctrine of modern science. So not only am I saying consciousness and the I experience within the human being originates out of the heart, and this is a teaching that you find throughout the religious traditions of Judaism, Islam, Christianity. It's also in the Baha'i religion. It's in Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. It's in Aleister Crowley. It's in Kabbalistic teachings. It's in numerous sources that our essential I is connected to the heart, and that there is actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And that's the idea of that we have a zero-point center, and there's a higher dimensional physics to our heart, and the dynamics of that physics produce through a holographic mechanism, the reality of our lives in four-dimensional space-time. So these are very complex ideas to understand, and I can't simply explain them easily, firstly because I don't fully understand them, and I'm striving to understand and comprehend and experience these types of dynamics. And I've been working at this for 20 to 30 years. And through time, I understand more and more and experience more and more of what I'm speaking of. But it's not something that can be simply grasped. It is valuable in your life, though, as you go about your life, to try to remember yourself every now and then. To bring, by self-remembering, I mean bringing your attention back to being awake in the moment right now, being here now, wherever you happen to be. To have moments of heightened wakefulness as you go about your lives. And to make an effort to do this every now and then and kind of wake up and kind of breathe and experience yourself in your body and be awake to your surroundings and what's going on around you and within you. This teaching, this method of self-remembering is taught in the Gurdjieff teaching, and the idea is we don't understand consciousness because we're not properly conscious. So we have to make an effort to wake up, to attain higher consciousness. We want to attain a higher state of consciousness. So we have to make these little mini efforts as we go through our day to have moments of heightened wakefulness. During these moments, very useful to be aware in your breath, because your breath is very closely tied to your soul life. And to enhance your breath gives you a great, can enhance your sense of presence within the moment. Okay, so we would struggle along to understand consciousness, and that involves the awakening of the heart, and with the awakening of the heart, the self, it brings about illumination, because the self element within the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating like the sun. So it's as if there's a little jiva atma, a spiritual spark within the heart, and the light of that spiritual spark, that light is our consciousness. So if we wake up, it's like we're illuminated because we experience all this influx of consciousness light from within the depths of our hearts. And this light can then illuminate. It's not only within the heart, but it circulates through the body and it can illuminate other centers. It can illuminate your higher centers, your third eye, so you might awaken your spiritual eye, be able to see into the subtle worlds through your third eye, or to experience the highest spiritual heaven through the crown chakra. So that we want to awaken in the heart. So I'm trying to explain some of the physics and religious views about the nature of zero-point energies and dynamics, and exploring this concept that human beings do have divine sparks. And these are related to the origins of our own consciousness. And consciousness is like light. And this self and consciousness originate out of the depths of the heart. And there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. So these are the general areas we're trying to explore, as well as in the show we range across political issues and social issues and other areas of what's happening within the contemporary scene. Okay, so today's show, I'm going to introduce my co-host, James Moffat, in a moment. And Jim and I are going to have some discussions, and we've both read a book called The God Theory by Bernard Hesch. And we're both very impressed with this book, and I think it's useful to review this book, both because, it's an acclaimed and popular book, and its subtitle is Universe's Zero-Point Fields and What's Behind It All. So Hesch is attempting to address the same kinds of issues and ideas as I try to address in my work. I would say in some areas his work is more advanced, and in other areas my work is more advanced. But this is what we'll try to look at today and through some comparative study on the book, The God Theory. And in the second half of the show, I've invited a guest, which is Michael St. Ange, who is a candidate and active member of the Canadian Action Party in Canadian politics. And the Canadian Action Party is a new political party which really is the only party to offer a true alternative to the mainstream political parties, which seem to have been bought out by the same system of kind of following corporate interests and so on and so forth. But anyway, we'll look at the platform of the Canadian Action Party, and we'll meet one of their representatives, Michael St-Ange from Ottawa, Ontario. And I think this CAP is a national party. They have candidates in most of the electoral districts throughout Canada. So I hope Canadians, if you're out there, you'll make an effort to learn about the Canadian Action Party and the issues that they're bringing up in the contemporary scene. And these, I think, are also really similar, related to the struggles in the United States with the growing awakening that's happening throughout the country. Because the issues are very much the same throughout North America. Okay, so with that introduction, Jim, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Okay, good. I didn't have time. I had hoped to be able to review the God theory a little bit more and try to encapsulate it all, but I've got a series of quotes, and I'm sure we'll be able to fill 45 minutes we have till Mike comes on to join us.
Yeah. I read it last year, and I've been rereading my own notes from it and taking notes from it. It's a very, very interesting book. Hayesh is a physicist and a fairly accomplished physicist in terms of publishing technical papers. And I believe he was the editor of the Journal of Astrophysics, if I'm not mistaken, for several years, and had been, I guess, a seminarian when he was younger, but dropped out. And it's very interesting because his although he's a physical scientist, he's not a materialist or a reductionist. And I think as in your email to me, you commented that some of the best comments from a scientist on the illusions and the limitations of materialism and reductionism that you'd ever read. I like his book in terms of talking about he talks about the zero point field and what that means. And as you said, has some very advanced ideas that are part of his academic publishing experience about how the zero point field interacts with physical reality and actually may provide a very an astonishingly alternative model of what, for instance, inertia is, and some very fundamental reworking and reconceptualization of fundamental ideas in physics. And
let's stay with that as you bring that up, and I'll just say something about what his view is of in terms of inertia, and trying to understand inertia has to do with understanding the idea of mass and what is mass. And mass is sometimes defined as like it exerts resistance to movement. Like this cup on my desk, if I attempt to push it through space, it encounters a certain resistance to its movement. So I have to exert a force to move a physical object. So it has inertia to it. It tends to stay in its same place unless you exert a force on it. So what is this basic property of matter or inertia? And Hesh's idea is, he's saying that the physical reality we ordinarily perceive is really only an illusion, and underlying it is this huge field of electromagnetic and zero-point energies, this kind of unifying field that underlies what's manifest to our senses. So when I attempt to move this cup, the matter in the cup, as I attempt to move it, interacts with the underlying zero-point field. So inertia is not simply intrinsic to mass, but it has to do with the zero-point fields. So when you move any, like, say any proton in space will tend to polarize space around it. So it has an influence on the zero-point field around it. So then if you try to move that material object, the proton moves along, interacting with the field of virtual particles which surround it at zero-point levels. So it interacts with the zero-point fields as you attempt to move it. Now, this is a very important idea of inertia, and gravity now is under proposed might similarly involve the zero-point fields. The old idea of gravity was that it was simply due to mass that two objects attract each other. And then Einstein defined space in terms of space-time curvature in the four-dimensional space-time. And gravity was seen to curvature in space. Now, in the newer ideas in quantum physics are that gravity might also be a variation of electromagnetic force, and it may involve electrodynamic interactions between objects and the underlying zero-point fields. So the Caltech group suggests that gravity is due to electromagnetic fluxes produced in space by the Earth, so that they're just electromagnetic fluxes that produce what we call gravity. So gravity is of an electromagnetic nature, and it has to do with zero-point fields. And this is very important, because if this is true, it opens up the possibility of developing, say, anti-gravity devices, UFO technologies, devices which neutralize the electromagnetic fluxes in space, so that they're not subject to gravitation. Also, you see the way UFOs move, and if they were moving ordinarily, they move at such speeds that anybody within them might be subject to like 9G, meaning 9-10 times the gravitational force of the Earth, which would have terrible kind of effects on the human's health. But that somehow, within spaceships, they might be able to neutralize these zero-point fields so that inertial effects, even through movement, wouldn't be experienced or felt. So the idea, then, in physics, I don't understand these issues fully, and as I say, neither do modern physicists, but this is the kind of new line of thinking about trying to understand the nature of mass and gravity as forces in physics. Okay, so to try to come back. So that, Jim, you mentioned that. That was just one aspect of Hesse's book, but I thought I'd just try to pick up on that a little bit.
Yeah, but maybe get back to the, you know, that's pretty far out. Get back to the basic idea of what the zero-point field is, and the quantum vacuum is, the paradox of the quantum vacuum is that it's both a void and a plenum, and that's what the zero point field refers to. I think that, you know, you should talk a little bit about that, because really one thing about, and I think it's Hesse actually is how you pronounce
Hesse?
It.
Okay,
and Hesse's work is I think very interesting, because what he's, and what you just talked about, the Caltech group and, you know, trying to conceptualize gravity in a different way, like, what all these things are pointing at is what David Bohm, a famous physicist who developed an understanding of these things in terms of the nature of reality in terms of an implicate and an explicate order. Like, the explicate order is a physical material reality that we can measure and observe, and then Bohm proposed that there's an implicate order, which is beyond our measurement and beyond our sensory detection, which is actually informing and sustaining our material reality. And what motivated Bohm? Bohm was a very accomplished theoretical physicist who had worked with Einstein and had really addressed what are called the hidden variables in both quantum mechanics and relativity theory, and what he noted in his work was that although quantum mechanics and relativity theory lead to very different understandings of the nature of reality, what he thought was what really provoked his whole development of the idea of the implicate order was that they both led to a view of the underlying unity of reality for completely different reasons. And he thought that this was like the most provocative paradox, is that you have these two theories which lead to a very different understanding of things in so many different ways, and yet both suggest that there are these hidden variables. There's something beyond what we understand, which is somehow integrally related to the manifestation of and sustaining of the physical world. And that's what I find really interesting, is this is also true of what Blavatsky's saying in The Secret Doctrine, and it's also true in the current conceptualizations of the zero-point field, is that more and more there's this understanding that we have to go beyond all the traditional notions about physics and the physical construction of reality. And so the most basic phenomena, such as gravity and inertia, and the most basic concepts really need to be thought of in very different ways. And there's starting to be truly exciting work developed in physics, which is very much consistent with the entire ancient esoteric tradition and the representations in those traditions of these higher dimensional realms of consciousness and being, which actually inform our physical material reality.
Yeah. So, okay. So
why don't you, sorry, I kind of
bring
went
it
off
back.
There,
but well,
but,
we, I,
yeah, maybe just talk about the basic idea of what
the zero point fields.
Yeah,
I thought I just opened the book. And I've got it here to the chapter 6 on the zero point field.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just go through this chapter. As I read things, I always mark certain things up, which I think are the key elements in his chapter. And he doesn't go into the zero point field extensively, but here are a few of the markings. He brings up first the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And he shows, it says that the implication of that is that it suggests any macroscopic object will also possess a residual, any microscopic object always possesses a residual random jiggle thanks to quantum fluctuations. So what it's kind of suggesting there, see, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle has to do in physics with the idea that one cannot know the exact position and momentum of a particle simultaneously. The more closely you measure the position of a particle, the more uncertainty there is about its momentum or energy level. Or the more closely you specify an energy level, the greater the uncertainty about its position. So that you can't know the exact position and momentum of a particle simultaneously. Now, for people with a knowledge of physics, this goes back to the Laplacian idea of the physical universe, that the physical universe is composed of elementary particles of some type which move around within empty space. And Laplace said if we knew the position of every particle and the position in space, and the momentum, we could predict with absolute certainty all future states of that system, that the universe was essentially a clockwork universe of billiard balls moving around in empty space and hitting each other and acting upon each other. But then the uncertainty principle said, no, in principle you cannot understand. You cannot know the position and momentum of a particle simultaneously. And the more precisely you define one variable, the greater the uncertainty about the other variable. And there's a famous equation, delta P times delta M is greater than or equal to Planck's constant. And the delta means the uncertainty about the position multiplied by the uncertainty about the momentum is always greater than or equal to Planck's constant, which is a small but positive number. Now, if you change this equation around, you would find that delta P is equal to Planck's constant divided by delta M. Now, if you, the delta M term is in the denominator. If you, in calculus, if you consider what happens is that delta M approaches zero, which means that the uncertainty about the momentum or energy level approaches zero, well, then the term on the right side of the equation approaches infinity. As the denominator approaches zero, then that factor approaches, becomes infinite. So it implies if you could, as you reduce your uncertainty about the position or momentum to zero, the other property becomes infinite. Okay, so you can't, Heisenberg compared it to the man and woman in a little weather house. And if it's raining, the woman comes out. And if it's sunny, the man comes out. But you can never have both the man and woman out at the same time. You can't have both at the same time. Okay, so what this all suggests is that in physics, there's a certain level at which you cannot measure any further because of the uncertainty principle. You go down to a certain level, and there's an exact figure, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters is the Planck's length. And beyond that level, measurement is completely indeterminate. It's immeasurable beyond that. It's like this infinite realm beyond measurement that lies beyond 10 to the 33 centimeters. So that's why in science they believe the universe originated as a singularity at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That's when negative existence emerged into positive existence. So the universe emerged from a singularity point, from the level of Planckian units. Okay, so to continue on with some quotes here. So he's saying, and if you add up all these ceaseless fluctuations that you get within the quantum vacuum, you get a background sea of light whose total energy is enormous. This is the electromagnetic zero-point field. In other words, create a vacuum, and what you are left with is the zero-point field full of zero-point energy. So if you imagine you take a bell jar and you create a vacuum in that bell jar and you block out all the electromagnetic radiation, so there's no particles in that space, he's saying there's still the zero-point energy. It's just latent within space itself. The vacuum, he writes, as a condition of complete emptiness, as an absolute void, does not exist. So you can never really have a vacuum because space isn't empty. Instead, it's the plenum. It's full of all this zero-point light energy fluctuations. He goes on, it may represent an unlimited source of energy available everywhere, and perhaps even a way to modify gravity and inertia. The quantum vacuum is, therefore, really a plenum. But in keeping with tradition, I will continue to use the term quantum vacuum. Okay, this is very interesting because in 1888, Blavatsky wrote, he says, space, which the scientists think is empty and void, is really the divine plenum. And within it is a correlation of all the forces. So Blavatsky says that it's in the emptiness of space itself, there's this unifying web of relationships that links everything in the universe, is interlinked within the zero-point fields. That's why Blavatsky says there is one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So there's one omniscience, there's one intelligence or information that thrills throughout every point of the universe. So this omniscience exists at those zero-point levels. See, it's at a level below the level of physical differentiation. So all this ties in, Jim, to what you were saying about Bohm, is the idea that, like, within the zero-point fields, are what Bohm would call the implicate orders, and then later he had different levels of this. He called the implicate orders, and then he had the super implicate orders, and then he had the ultimate void, even beyond those. He had those different levels, all latent at zero point levels.
And that's actually a comment I had about Hayes's book and his conceptualization. I mean, he's certainly familiar with esoteric teachings, but one of the things that I noted in it was that he talks about this field, and one of the things he says about the quantum, about the zero-point field is that it's in a very low energy state. That's why it's not manifest, not visible, if I understand him correctly. But then he's saying that, you know, this field is, you know, is affecting everything in terms of the material plane that we observe. But he doesn't sort of have the idea that there might be fields. I mean, I think he may actually suggest this at some point, but he doesn't explore it. But in terms of the model that appears throughout esoteric teachings, there are higher dimensions beyond that. Like Bohm started with the implicate order, but then he thought, well, okay, there's a higher order beyond the implicate order, which is the super implicate order. And I would say, you know, that there's probably a super, super implicate order, you know, like,
yeah,
I mean, in terms of, like, the ladder order of creation, the,
yeah,
in Gurdjieff's terms, the ray of creation and the seven worlds that come from the unity to the bottom of the octave. But it's interesting, and the other thing that he talks about is he talks about how this field creates polarities. Like, nothing in the manifest physical world would exist if it wasn't for polarities, which is right. Like, there's got to be these two sides to things. But in the esoteric teachings, it's like the sacred law of three is repeated in every esoteric or religious tradition. There's the third force, which, I mean, in a way, he's saying that everything is a result of this third hidden force, but he doesn't, he talks about polarity, but he doesn't talk about the Trinity and the Holy Trinity, which I thought was
yeah, no, I don't think he grasped that element,
yeah,
in esoteric teachings
as significantly as
we have through our work.
Yeah, and I would say that's absolutely essential. I mean, that's at the heart of really the esoteric teaching as well. So in Gurdjieff's terms, it's one of the sacred cosmic laws. But I mean, it's in the three gunas in Hinduism, and it's in the three zazahat and Kabbalah. I mean, it recurs throughout, and it's in the Christian Trinity, of course. I mean, it recurs throughout all of the major esoteric teachings, and it's like it's one of those central defining elements of esotericism, which I thought was a bit peculiar. And as again, he doesn't seem to have the idea of hierarchy. Like, he's got this level and that level. Like, in a way, it's a bit,
yeah, he's got like the familiar reality and then the zero point field.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it's kind of dualistic in that way.
Yeah, yeah,
not the idea of there being levels. Yeah,
yeah. But then when he explains, like, and but what he, one of the things that he does grasp, and well, I'll let you go on, but I mean, he talks about, he really grasps the importance of light and how you can differentiate between light, which is a familiar electromagnetic phenomena, which we might call small L light, and then light, which is this higher element of consciousness, intelligence, whatever you want to call it, which is light, like big L. So I'll let you go on, though, about the zero point.
Yeah, the big L light is like within the zero point fields,
yeah,
which,
yeah,
is, it's like this kind of sea of infinite light. Like, he talks about light at one point, and if you're traveling at the speed of light or exist in the realm of light, there is no time. There
right.
is no time. So it's kind of this timeless realm that underlies and sustains the time or temporal processes which we observe, but it's all sustained by this kind of timeless realm of light within the zero point fields.
Yeah, I thought one of the very interesting, nice ways he put things is he said that Einstein used the idea of the propagation of light, like, you know, if a photon is traveling, it's the propagation of light, to define the space-time complex. And he said, I'm suggesting that the propagation of light creates the space-time complex, which is, you know, I think, you know, a step beyond sort of what Einstein saw. And then at one point he says something about the impossibility of an observer traveling like a photon, but then, you know, which immediately made me think of Yogananda's experience,
yeah,
and how he accounts for his experience of cosmic consciousness, where he says that master yogis are able to identify with the universal structure because they are traveling at the speed of light. So there is no here or there, and there is no time. Like, you know,
It's like in your light body.
Yeah.
You're in that timeless realm.
Yeah, and you've transcended all the lower dimensions, and so you can actually, I mean, he describes how he sees worlds, you know, being created and destroying and resolving and dissolving and you know, he sees all of this, but he's beyond time and he's beyond space because he is a light, but he's in his light body, which is interesting. That again, like I say, Hayes brings this up, but he doesn't kind of explore it in terms of like the what I would call the full blown mystical experience of true cosmic consciousness, you know, which is interesting, but again, like as he said, like what's really critical is that he says that this zero point field is through the sea of light is interacting with the physical material plane that we can observe and measure and conceptualize in modern physics. But this is all sort of everything. We're sort of perturbations of that sea of light, or we're being the material reality is being created by that light, which is entirely consistent with what you're saying in your work about, but sort of taking it beyond in terms of human beings are also created in this way.
See, there are aspects of his book which I say are like completely consistent with my own work, but I would say he makes a couple mistakes with like things I completely have a different view from, which I'll come to in a moment. But more broadly, I would say he's not widely studied enough within the esoteric tradition, and he doesn't draw heavily from that.
No.
He draws mainly from some Kabbalistic writings and some other sources, but I mean, very valuable material. But I think in my own work, I develop a much more differentiated model of the levels of existence and how things work through zero-point centers. He doesn't have the idea, really, that human beings might have a zero-point center in the zero-point field. He doesn't conceive that.
No.
Even though in his book, whenever I read a book, if I ever find a reference where someone references something which I would call the zero-point concept, I always put a little circle there with a dot in the center to mark up my book.
Yeah.
And I in the back of my book, as I read a book, I'll keep notes. So I, at the back of my book, I have a little circle with a point in the center. And this symbol, the circle with the point in the center, is what Mystic Ivanov says is the symbol of the initiate. And he says this center is in us, and we need to find this center. So this is an idea, this is a kind of ancient mystical symbol, a circle with a point in its center. In The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky uses this symbol to depict the origin of the universe in The Secret Doctrine, a circle with a first point of differentiation. So the point represents the point of differentiation, and the circle represents space. But anyway, so I have three pages here in his book where he referenced what I would call the zero-point concept, and I'll just read his quote. First one, page 33. He's talking about the... Russell argues that the fourth state of consciousness is that of the pure white light itself, not filtered or affected in any way by the objects of consciousness. This pure self-awareness is your ultimate consciousness. So here we see, as an aside, that he's equating consciousness and light, exactly as we argue, Jim, and present through our work. He says this pure self-awareness is your ultimate consciousness. It is reported to be a state of peace and bliss. That's tied into what I talk about, what's called the bliss sheath within the heart. That's what mystics call it. It's got the Anandamaya Kosha, the bliss sheath within the heart. Now, he doesn't relate it to the heart, but he has this idea that this state of pure consciousness is associated with the experience of bliss. An awareness that the pure consciousness experienced is but a concentration point within a single universal consciousness. Okay, so here he's referring to, quote, a concentration point within a single universal consciousness. See, there's the zero point.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, he never explores that seriously
no,
as a
no.
scientific idea, but he he mentions it, kind
of. Yeah, he recognizes it, but he doesn't develop the idea.
Yeah, and that's kind of exactly what I'm saying when I say we have zero-point centers, that they're, in a way, we're a concentration point of that universal consciousness.
Yeah, and the human being, it can be thought of as a quantum system with the heart as the center of the system.
Yeah, of a human being.
Being rooted into this higher dimensional complex, which forms and sustains it and is the source of consciousness and life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thanks for it. That's excellent. Yeah, the heart. And even if we take a human being as a quantum system, well, the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the brain in the head. So if we were to ask a person, like, where is your basic self-experience? In a way, electromagnetically, one would think the self would be related to the heart. Which is because we are quantum systems. Everything in nature and all our processes are electromagnetic in nature. But, so by far, the heart is the basis of a human being as a quantum system, and the mind is secondary, exactly as the mystics say. Okay, so here he does mention, that is the idea that we're kind of explaining through zero-point studies, is that there's an actual physics, a higher-dimensional physics and metaphysics to the human heart. And it has to do with these zero-point centers and the idea of there being a higher-dimensional space wherein things are interrelated and all parts of a unifying whole. Consciousness is like light. This is very important. And there's kind of like, in mystical teachings, you have light on different levels of creation. Like Blavatsky talks about lower occultism, or what I would call black magic, that the expertise of this people, for Blavatsky, is at the level of the astral light. And that astral light is a lower psychical realm relative to the light of the spiritual realm, or the light within the Akasha, or the underlying hyperspace. So they become enamored by the astral light. Now, the astral light reflects the nature of the supernal light, but on a lower level of reflection.
Yeah.
So the whole issue of what is light, see, this is a basic mystery, even in science. It's like the simplest questions are the most impossible for scientists to really comprehend, eh? Like even something like the light is a mystery in modern physics. Although we can describe its behavior in different ways, when it comes to it, ultimately we can't really define what it is.
No, it's like that great Tom Robbins quote, which I've cited on this program before, where he says, scientists have discovered and recorded, quote, laws, unquote, to which electricity, gravity, and magnetism adhere, but they have practically no understanding of what these forces are or why.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we define things by their physical effects, but we kind of don't understand them in their metaphysical root.
Yeah, and we don't understand their essential nature, and as you say, and now, that's what I was trying to get at earlier when I said that this whole idea of the quantum vacuum of the zero-point fields is that these hidden dimensions which are interacting and informing and sustaining the physical world lead to a completely different model of and a completely different basis for understanding these fundamental terms in physics and no doubt in chemistry and life sciences. You know, this is again, as you say, like, Hayes's book is really interesting. I mean, you have to send him a copy of The Heart Doctrine for sure.
Yeah, I really felt that. I think
I think he'd be fascinated by it because I think it's just, as you say, I think you develop a lot of material that is entirely consistent with his model, but is much more integrates the esoteric perspective and takes things that has a much more sophisticated conceptualization of consciousness too. But as again, like I was reading, and I'm reading it where he says that, you know, that about an observer not being able to travel as a photon, and then so I thought immediately of Yogananda, as we always talk about. So The consciousness of a perfected yogi, this is from Autobiography of a Yogi, is effortlessly identified not with a narrow body, but with the universal structure. Gravitation is powerless to compel a master to exhibit the property of weight, the distinguishing gravitational condition of all material objects. He who knows himself as the omnipresent spirit is subject no longer to the rigidities of a body in time and space. A yogi who, through perfect meditation, has merged his consciousness with the creator, perceives the cosmological essence as light, and then he's got in brackets, vibrations of life energy. To him, there is no difference between the light rays composing water and the light rays composing land. Free from matter consciousness, free from three dimensions of space and the fourth dimension of time, a master transforms his body of light with equal ease over or through the light rays of earth, water, fire, and air. He sees the universe as the Lord created, an essentially undifferentiated mass of light.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's exactly what he's saying.
And that's precisely what Mr. Hayes is, Dr. Hayes is saying in his book. I mean, and as I say, he certainly addresses, the what he thinks is the misrepresentation that consciousness emerges from matter in modern scientific thought, and you know, is very well aware that the mystics and esoteric teachers say that it's the other way around, that matter, consciousness is primary and matter is secondary. But as I say, he doesn't really, I could see that he's not as familiar with the corpus of esoteric and mystical teachings as you or I might be, and doesn't, you know, see these obvious connections. So as I say, I think he'd be really fascinated by your work, you know.
I do too, because my work kind of we're so congruent with the basic belief and experience and understanding, and yet my work is much more advanced in okay, so we're both going to try to speak up here. I had two other points, Jim, where I had circled, where I had my circle with central point.
Okay.
Two other quotes. So the first was page 33, and then I realized one was page 32. Your conscious being is of the very same stuff as God's. Okay, and that's the idea. This is my aside. That's the idea in spiritual teachings. Like Prabhupada, Swami Prabhupada says that, like, God is this kind of infinite fire and it throws off these spiritual sparks. So the idea is everybody has one of these God sparks within you that is of the same stuff as this God, that is of the same stuff as what exists within this kind of higher dimensional zero point field somehow. So we all have the same stuff as God's. Okay, then back to the book. Your immortal spirit is filtered from God's immortal spirit. Each of us is like one tiny dot of color on the slide of brilliant complexity, and God is the white light of potential out of which we have emerged. Okay, so there is the idea that like we're like one dot of color or light or a ray. Each of us is a ray, a dot of light, a dot of color. And that's what the zero point concept is saying. Yes, let's take that seriously, that we all have that zero point center. So that's a nice quote, eh, Jim?
Yeah, and I mean, even like that idea, the dot is, in a way, it really captures things that in terms of individuality, but at the same time, that dot, like if you go in within that dot into the higher dimensions, then things resolve, and eventually you realize that there's no difference, there's no separation between the individual spark and the consuming fire, or the divine fire. Like it on some level, everything resolves, so that there's no separation, there's no,
yeah, because that God is this kind of like sea of infinite light.
Yeah.
Infinite light and potential that thrills throughout the zero point field. So we can kind of connect in that, and the the self can even dissolve into that infinite sea and lose its self, sense of selfness, a separateness, or it can emerge back into selfhood out of that. We emerge from that and we can resolve back into it. Here's the third quotation. This is a little bit earlier. It reads, why would an individual spark of divine consciousness choose to limit its experience of physical existence to only, say, 80 years of life in Bakersfield?
That's great.
It has a neat, it's a neat little. So here he has that idea, individualized spark of divine consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so he has references to that, to the, what I would call the zero point concept, or divine spark concept, through the book, but mainly at those moments he's talking more metaphorically, poetically, speaking from his heart. But he's not really kind of taking that as an idea. Well, if that's so, let's think out, what does that mean? If there was an individualized spark of divine consciousness which limits its experience to 80 years of life in Bakersfield.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't, okay, well, how could that work then? You know, what it would be the physics of that? Because then you got to start thinking of human beings then as having some central point that is that point from which the consciousness as light and the life. I think there's not, this zero point center is the origin not only of consciousness as light, but also of life, the livingness of something.
Yeah.
Okay. So those are three quotes I found through his book to what I would call the zero point concept, but it's not something he develops. I think that one of the things that strikes me most, how he's similar to Blavatsky in the esoteric view, is that it's very feasible that there is this kind of realm of omniscient light that underlies and sustains all things, and that everything is kind of interrelated through this hard dimensional realm of light. So he has that basic concept, and he is saying, in modern physics, there's nothing we know that's incompatible with this. In fact, all this conceptualization of the mystics of this realm of light, he says it's quite consistent with modern quantum theory. And that, I think, is the main thrust of his book. And I think let's return to this next week, Jim, because there are a number of, I disagree with him in his book about the idea. He says consciousness creates matter.
Yeah.
So he's saying, instead of matter creating consciousness, he's saying, no, consciousness creates matter. And there again, that's different from my perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that's dualistic thinking, that there's consciousness and matter.
Yeah.
And I think it's, as in Vedic teachings, they're said to be Purusha and Prakriti as manifestations of Brahman. So there's really a triunity of Brahman, the God source, which then differentiates into the polarity of Purusha, which is spirit and represents consciousness, versus Prakriti, which represents material nature.
Right.
So these are the divine mother and the divine father. In Kabbalistic teachings, it's Chakma as the divine father, the supernal father, and Bana as the divine mother. So I would not argue that, I would argue that consciousness does not create physical reality, and that consciousness is something separate from what are called the modes of nature. But this is an important subject, and I noticed we're coming to five, so I was trying to bring, let's come back to this next week, Jim, and continue another week with this book. And
I just wanted to say something quickly that from that he talks about. He says it's acceptable today. My levels were off earlier, apparently. I'm trying to talk a little bit louder. I hope I can be.
Yeah, I'm hearing you a bit better.
Okay, it's acceptable today, even fashionable, to publish scientific papers that propound theories of invisible universes that may be adjacent to our own in other dimensions. And then he says, if a religious person talks about transcendental spiritual realities, however, he or she is often scoffed at. For some reason, the 11 or 26 dimensional string worlds of scientific theory are plausible, but the supernatural realms of mysticism are judged to be mere superstition. And he says at the end, indeed, it seems to me that there is a better empirical evidence for the existence of God than there is for the many dimensions of string theory. And you sent me that quote, Chris, that you really liked, where he says that the evidence to support the idea of a random universe is precisely zero.
Yeah, that is really no evidence
there's
to
none.
Support.
Yeah, this is a physicist saying this, which I thought was, I mean, this is a very uplifting book for people who want to go beyond the tried and beyond the usual misrepresentations of the nature of reality and the denial of spiritual reality and the whole adherence to the dogma of materialism and reductionism. And that's what's so encouraging about this book, is that it's a physicist who's writing this, and
it's written very nicely.
Oh, it is.
It's very readable.
Yeah, totally engaging.
Yeah, and he writes from himself, his nice sense of his personal sense to him. So we will return to that
we'll
next week.
Back,
and,
yeah,
good. Okay, so we'll move on the second half of the show. I think our guest is online. It's Michael St. Ange of the Canadian Action Party. Michael, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Chris and Jim.
You hear us okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Michael, some major kind of things are happening in the Canadian Action Party. You've had a leader, Connie Fogel, who's really been a very brave and outspoken representative of the Canadian Action Party. I saw a wonderful clip of her the other day, some of her talks on YouTube and the Internet. She's a very strong speaker, and I guess she's a Vancouver lawyer, and how long has she been head of the Canadian Action Party?
Well, she, I believe I got elected in 2001.
In 2001, yes. So 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, it's a shame to lose Connie. She's been such an eloquent spokesperson and so brave and kind of facing the problems we're facing.
Yeah, and it's going to be really, really difficult to find somebody to replace her at her caliber. You know, like, we've been having a growing membership list, but what's semi-concerning is that we've put up on the website for about 2-3 weeks now that we're looking for a leader and haven't really had too much interest. So we're all hanging tight, looking to see if somebody is really going to put their foot forward.
Yeah.
Problem is that there's a $10,000 deposit that's required
to do that.
To run as leader, yes.
Oh yeah, my goodness.
Well, this was in the Constitution.
Is that self-created or is that a federal thing?
No, that's self-created. That's within the CAP Constitution.
Wow.
So there was some discussion to try to, that we might want to amend that. But an amendment takes a lot of time for a party. Especially the Constitution requires that we advise all members 30 days in advance by mail that there would be such a
proposal.
A vote and let people dwell on it, you know.
Yeah.
So.
That's all awkward. So, are all the executive positions up for grabs? Like, is that what's happening? Is there a complete, or is it just the leadership position?
No, all executive positions are going to be up for grabs.
And is this all going to be dealt with at the convention? You have a convention coming up in Ottawa on, is it August 22nd?
21st. Or yeah, 22nd. Yeah, you're right.
22nd.
And the only thing that's not going to happen is we're not having the leadership nomination at that moment. We'll be announcing that it's happening.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Although we have, like, generally speaking, already for a couple weeks on the website, but it'll be I believe a lot of members will get more information at that point.
Yeah. Well, that may be a good idea to have a convention that brings people together, because that may move some people to, you know, step forward and you know, make it a more of a leadership race and to give people support among yourselves as a community with
this
common purpose, you know.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, yeah, that could be valuable. Do you know how many people, members the Canadian Action Party has?
Not total. I don't know how many we have total, but I know that just in Ottawa, for example, Ottawa Centre has about 57 members.
But yeah, really?
Yeah.
Good.
Ottawa Vanier has 25. Ottawa East and all the rest, they all have about in the 20s.
Yeah, yeah, good. Excellent.
Yeah, so we have a really strong membership, which is why in the area we've been starting to create electoral district associations, because these groups of members need to be, or have the right to be represented. So we've been doing electoral associations.
You developed the first support group in your district, eh? That's the first for the Canadian Action Party that you actually formed. What's the committee called?
I'm very, very proud to say that actually the EDA that we have in Ottawa Vanier.
What is the term EDA?
Electoral District Association.
That you have in Ottawa.
And this is basically a body that allows this association essentially to raise funds, spread the word about CAP year round.
Yeah.
So it's really a good a backbone for a campaign to have such an EDA. Now, we're the first ones in Canada since the time of Paul Hellyer.
Who founded the party in what year?
97. And at that time, at that very first election, Canadian Action Party had a pretty good showing, I believe.
Too. Oh, really?
Yeah, in that very first year.
Yeah.
But then after that, not too sure what happened. Unfortunately, people kind of got lost interest. I think at that time it was a lot of talk about NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah.
And they were very popular out in the western provinces as well.
Yeah. So, and I guess historically, like one of the main concerns of the Canadian Action Party is the monetary system. Like, it's similar to in the States, everybody's waking up to the Federal Reserve and saying, like, holy smokes, how come we're allowing all the bankers to create the money and impoverish a nation, and how did this happen? And everybody traces it back to 1913, I guess, the Federal Reserve was established. And how did this happen? And it happened, everybody was away on vacation and just signed it away, and it kind of enabled this group of bankers to kind of take over the control of the nation. Is it Rothschild who said, I care not who makes the laws, all I care about is who prints the money, or something?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And
so that's how the kind of banking institutions...
And what's sad is in Canada, we always had the ability to create our own money. And I think that a lot of Canadians, you know, generally are very overtaken by the American media and don't really know a whole lot about Canada themselves, and don't really understand that our Federal Reserve belongs to us. And it's not really a Federal Reserve, it's our central banking system is owned by the people.
Yeah.
So
and so the government could print its own money instead of borrowing it from the bankers.
That's right.
But in Canada, that's not completely done. They, I understand, still create some themselves through the Bank of Canada, but then they also borrow from the banking institutions.
Right, but they only borrow, I believe, like a small percentage, like 0.5 of our money from the Bank of Canada.
So they've essentially given control over creation of money in Canada to the banking. That's why the bankers and corporate elite own the political parties.
That's
would
right.
You say?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, they do. They're obviously, the political parties no longer serve the people in Canada. They serve the bankers and the corporations. I mean, you see that in all their policies and all their actions, I would say. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, they have the total control over politicians at the moment.
Yeah. So what proportion, when we pay tax money, what proportion of that is going to the banksters, banking gangsters? Or I call them banksters
well,
now.
From what, right? From what I know, we collected, the one statistics I know is for 2006, and in that year we collected $630 billion in income tax, and 33% of it went towards the interest off the debt.
So just off the interest, and that doesn't
right.
even lead the main debt is untouched.
That's right. That's right. And that if imagine in freeing up that debt would or that interest would give us an additional $200 billion a year.
Wow.
And
wow.
Which is why I say it'd be very simple to say, okay, well, let's consolidate our debt. Let's borrow from the Bank of Canada and pay off the banks.
Borrow from the Bank of Canada to pay
interest free, so we'll consolidate
yeah.
our debt.
Yeah.
So therefore,
wow.
the value of the dollar stays the same because it's a supply demand. So we're not creating more money. What we're doing is we're transferring the debt from the bankers to the Bank of Canada, and all
yeah.
of a sudden, no more interest payments.
Yeah.
But you know that would have economic consequences. Obviously, the banks would have a really hard time.
How would the banks? The banks are so unreasonably greedy and rich, and
it works
what,
on the stock market.
Sorry.
Well, it would work on the stock
market. On the stock market,
they
their
would
stocks would fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't do it all at once.
No, it would have to be a gradual thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's definitely possible, and imagine the prosperity after that.
Yeah.
You know, seniors right now across Canada. Are saying how their pensions, namely the old age security and the guaranteed income supplement, is only getting a $2 increase over last year due to the inflation. Yet, inflation is much, much, much worse than that. Now they're skimping out on our seniors.
Yeah. No, I mean, the way I see the government going is that they're going to try to undermine it so they don't have to pay people's pensions. I think that's their scheme. That's somehow my suspicion.
Yeah. And the funny thing is the money's there.
The money's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're meeting all their obligations thus far. Like, yeah.
And we're paying off the bankers, you know.
Yeah. So the Canadian Action Party, okay, so that's one of the major platforms, is financial reform and to more actively use the Bank of Canada. And that's kind of restructuring the financial system, just like they need in the United States, where people are waking up to this issue.
Yeah, thank God to Ron Paul over there.
Yeah.
For bringing the issue to light.
Yeah.
And Aaron Russo and a few other people out in the U.S. that really brought that to light.
Yeah. Yeah, in the States even, it seems that the federal income tax is not even lawful. It's not really been fully instituted in terms of statutory regulation and such, I understand.
That's right. It's completely illegal.
Yeah.
Well, it's illegal in the fact that it's not constitutional in the U.S.
Yeah.
I don't think
it's the one tax that on your income that you can't, that they don't actually have the right to garnish, unless I believe in wartime.
Yeah, that was the main subject of Aaron Russo's movie From Freedom to Fascism,
right.
Which is an amazing, remarkable movie, shocking movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's actually what initiated me into looking into things. Actually, I think that was one of the very first videos that I saw that made me understand money and monetary policies.
Yeah,
kind of went from there.
Yeah.
Well, what is our dollar? Mean? What is our dollar? What's the value of our dollar? Was it gold? And in the end, I actually found out that our value has pretty much zero value. It's created out of thin air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so so let's leave that at the financial monetary reform. How about other kind of what you see as the most important message of the Canadian Action Party or other policies that you have?
Well, I sort of really do believe that recently with the direction of Connie Fogel, probably one of the biggest things of the Canadian Action Party, and this is probably just my opinion, more than policy and everything, is that we're very much a party that's listening to the people and creating a voice for, you know, essentially just all the wrongdoings that are happening. I mean, the list is as long as my arm.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about, you know, in terms of policy, we'll have 9/11. But when you go on our website frequently enough, you'll see that we also talk about fluoride in our water and chemtrails.
Yeah.
And a lot of current issues that are being covered up. And our politicians have complete control over this. And but they're not talking about it. They're failing our citizens. So
yeah.
we want to be that voice.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
No, I see the Canadian Action Party as the only hope in Canadian politics. I mean, I see all the four parties have all bought out into the corporate agenda, and they're controlled by the banking and corporate elite community. I mean, that's why they all got money. They can afford $10,000 to run for leadership. You know, it's not a problem. I mean, they got so much money, they're so greedy as parties that they've become the servants of the corporations and banksters. And that's who they serve. I mean, that's why they never serve Canadians. You know, we get sprayed by chemtrails all the time. Government doesn't say anything. You know, government doesn't protect us from the terrorists in our skies.
Yeah.
They don't protect us from the fluoride in the water used by the Nazis in concentration camps to dull people down. It's put in our water, and the government doesn't do anything because the corporations make money off it and dull it down.
And I challenge people to email or write to their members of parliament to get some kind of an answer on some of these things, because the answer that they'll get is this, you know, this whitewash sort of reply that makes, you know, like, for example, I have a friend who wrote to their local mayor about the fluoride in the water, and he gets this answer that it's good for your teeth and it's a good idea and all this other stuff, and that's really what they want you to hear. So it's not really even truthful. So the people who are representing you are being dishonest, it feels like, a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or they're not educating themselves, or what? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think likely both, because they're compartmentalized. I don't think most politicians really grasp the evil, the beast that's kind of they're part of. You know, they think it's just fluoride in the water, and I know all the kids should have their shots. Oh yes, just, you know, let's get all our young girls, give them Gardasil vaccinations. You know, like, you know, because the corporate elite, they make lots of money for the big pharma mafia. You know.
Right, and they spin it so that parents think that this is a good idea, but they don't get the information that it hasn't been tested. And many young girls in Australia have already tried this vaccine, the HPV vaccine, and died.
Yeah. Yeah, they've made numerous adverse effects. Plus, they couldn't possibly have researched its long-term effects properly. Because you need to research it on a long-term effect. Like, what are the long-term effects of injecting these toxic viral matter into your body? You know, like, people...
Well, you can say that basically about any pharmaceutical or chemical product that's introduced into the marketplace. I mean,
yes.
I said the whole testing in the States, the FDA, is a complete and utter joke. I mean, it's bought out by Big Pharma I mean, even a process like laser eye surgery, nobody really knows what the long-term effects are of that. That's a very popular procedure, and people have it all the time. But it's, you know, we don't really know what the effects are because you haven't had enough time. I mean, everything's like that.
All sorts of
things are introduced.
Irradiated food.
Well, you know, then you get to the really serious ones, you know, like, I mean, yeah, irradiated food.
Well, and what's really been popular lately is the bisphenol A.
Is the what?
Bisphenol A. it's a chemical that they put into hard plastic,
polycarbonate,
and it's being shown to make you sterile. So they had a lot of baby bottles out on the market with this bisphenol A, and all of a sudden Toys R Us scooped them all off the market, and Health Canada is throwing out a warning on bisphenol A, which is this chemical in hard plastics.
Well, that's good. That, I mean, that's one, then credit to them for that.
Yeah.
That's
that,
right.
That's one
but
instance
it was years
where they
after
did
the fact. You know, I mean, this stuff has been out for how long?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Still.
Things aren't being properly tested before even going out. And,
yeah,
and,
that,
and
that's
it's
the
probably
going
to get worse with the SPP. And
So they're okay. So yeah, so the Canadian Action Party, I mean, that's what I like. So you're addressing, you want to bring up these issues of fluoridation of the water, the chemtrail spraying, the genetically modified foods, the irradiated foods, the depletion of our food supply. You're bringing up all these kinds of issues which are part of the new, against the New World Order agenda, really.
Yeah. Well, it's pro-people is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's we're not bought out by corporations. So
yeah.
Just like you, I'm concerned about my water. And just like, you know, the guy next door, I'm concerned about those same things too. I think, you know, what's great is that we're a bit of a guy next door party. I know a lot of the a lot of the candidates are just regular people who are sick and tired of politics and took the time to sit there and read up on the issues and understand them.
Yeah, learn what's going on.
Yeah,
it's
and the
CAP so
website, CanadianActionParty.ca, is a great source of information for that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
you know, you can start there and go off and look at these different things.
And it's very valuable to be on their mailing list. Like I know I've been on the mailing list for the last year, and that's why I respect your party so much because you know I've had emailings on fluoride, inoculations, implants. You know, the New World Order agenda, 9/11, all of these issues that the Canadian Action Party informs its members and is raising that are all the issues that our politicians won't answer truthfully.
That's right. And included, I don't know if you've noticed, but there's been an increase of emails about UFO disclosure.
Yeah.
You know, which is another thing that no other politician in their right mind would bring up. But we're different, which is what I really like.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That is interesting. That goes back even to the formation of the party, and Hellyer was a Canadian defense minister under Trudeau.
Right.
And then he said there's, you know, there's evidence, there's UFOs here, and he I think it goes back even to there. Can you say something of that, Mike?
I'm not sure, actually, about that. I know that he's really active about it now and was very active speaking against the weaponization of space. And he's made a couple of videos talking with Stephen Greer and a few other people. So he's really been talking about it. Now, this is our founder.
Yeah.
So I do follow a lot of his stuff, and our party does still follow a little bit of information from Paul. So...
Yeah, so you want this issue addressed, like disclosure around ETs, and I mean, a lot of people feel that there are very advanced technologies available which have been kept from people because of the monopoly of the corporations, and they're not wanting to undermine their own oil supplying and hydro supplying, like they've kept free energy devices off the market in order to maintain their control. I think that, would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. You know, we've seen that with the EV1. And that's in, like, 1991. Now, just very recently, they came out with a car that ran on electricity solely. But the oil companies and the car company themselves really just said, took it completely off the market. And I really do believe that it was a scare in terms of its own popularity. Because this car... You know, from what I understand, this is all documented in the...
Who killed the electric car?
Yeah, who killed the electric car.
Yeah.
Where, you know, this car would really go. You press on the gas, you have something like 120 miles an hour with incredible range. And this is in 1991.
Wow.
yet the oil companies and the gas companies saw that, well, you know, well, we're not going to be selling as many filters. We're not going to be doing the oil changes and all these negative impacts of this car, so they took it off. But they didn't just take it off the market. They ripped out of people's driveways and ran off with them, canceling their leases. So this was a real scare.
Wow. There's also a fellow I saw on YouTube. There, I don't know if the inventor, his name was Gray, and he developed a car that would run completely off water.
Water, yeah.
And he had a prototype that was functioning, and he even contacted like the State Department in the United States, and the military became interested in it. And he died mysteriously shortly afterwards from poisoning, and his invention, I guess, has been swallowed up.
That's right. His name was Stephen Meyer.
Meyer.
Yeah.
Okay. Or Meyer, yeah.
Yeah. And they said he died of food poisoning as he walked out of a restaurant, which is very fishy to me, because as far as I know, most of the food poisonings I'm aware of, it takes a couple hours. You don't walk out of a restaurant and keel over. Food poisoning, certainly, and
even
you know,
if it wasn't a suspicious death, then what is suspicious is, well, how come his invention wasn't brought forward?
Yeah.
You know, like what happened to
guy? Just because this guy died doesn't mean the invention should die too.
Here's all you people who want to have a global tax to save the world and save the polar bears who can't swim far enough, and meanwhile here's someone who can run a car. He said he could get from the west coast to the east coast on 22 gallons of water.
That's right. And, well, and the government has a history of doing that with inventors and going in days after their deaths and swiping all their information. They did this with Stephen Meyer, but they did it also with the greatest inventor, in my opinion, Nikola Tesla.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shortly after he died, they went in there and cleared out all this information.
Yeah,
because Tesla had an idea about using the Earth as a standing wave, as sort of like, you know, he was talking about a clean and free energy source, that you could use the Earth as a standing wave and tap into that, and that was one of his primary goals after the invention of the Tesla coil, that to try to develop this idea. But I want to just mention something that I heard today, Michael, that I think that the Canadian Action Party should try to inform people about. This was I don't know if you're familiar with the CBC program, Quirks and Quarks, the science program. Anyway, it's on at noon on Saturdays, and I just happened to catch the last few minutes of it today. And what they were talking about was geothermal technology, and the guy was explaining that basically, realistically, the technology exists now, like where people can heat and provide electricity and air condition their homes by tapping into the Earth's heat. You know, they put a pipe in. This is all.
Wow.
This is done all the time. It's done in thousands of homes.
And in fact, people should know, if anybody's listening from New Brunswick, that the government of New Brunswick is providing loans for people to install these geothermal systems.
Oh,
wow.
That's really encouraging, because that's what, when the guy came back on, you know, they're talking to these different people and they're explaining, you know, I think it's something like, I think it's like 30% of the energy consumption in Ontario goes directly to heating and cooling buildings. And the guy was saying, you know, you can reduce this by 65-70% by using this technology, and it exists. But he said, you know, what has to change is the economics of it, because, of course, like every other alternate energy project, the cost isn't over time. The cost is at the front. It's the startup cost that dissuades people from investing in the technology. But as he said, you know, I mean, your heating and electrical bills are like a fraction of what they are using natural gas or oil or electricity, and it just seems like that. I mean, I don't own a home, but I know if I bought a home, the first thing I would do is I would invest in this technology, because it's just like, you know, it's a win-win situation.
The problem is that those systems, depending on where you live, like, for example, I've heard about this for a while, and I've looked into it, and my house is built on a rock bed in Hall, Elmer, or Hall, Quebec, and it's solid rock.
Yeah.
So if I were to try to install such a system, which basically pumps these pipes, like, I don't know how deep into the ground to harness that the heat from there, would be extremely expensive.
Yeah.
The government absolutely needs to be providing these subsidies.
Yeah.
And there's other, like the wind power. I mean, that could be used much more widely.
Well, absolutely. That's
different areas might be useful for different things. Like I saw very interesting wind farms in Alberta.
Right.
I mean, I like the appearance of them. At one point, some people were saying they complained because they didn't think they were attractive. I saw them and thought they were quite beautiful.
I like them aesthetically, but unlike the beauty of a nuclear power plant. what planet are people on when they complain about wind farms, about the unsightly turbines? It's like you've really got to be dissociated from reality to raise that as an objection.
I thought that was part of their propaganda to undermine it. I thought, that the New World Order wanted to raise this as a problem.
But it's like anything else. There's money to be made, you know, if the more it becomes popular, you know. I mean, this guy was saying, talking about the geothermal, he said, this is going to be a multi-billion-dollar business.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of dough in it, and that's one of the great myths about alternate energy and trying to change to cleaner energies and to technology that conserves. Everywhere where it's done, people make money. You know, it's changing out of an old paradigm, and it's going against certain market forces that exist and don't want you to replace them: oil and gas, coal. You know, but realistically, that's just a complete, you know, in most cases, that's just a complete myth. And the more open people are to, as Michael hit it right on the head, if the government subsidizes, that's what I was thinking, like, somebody gives you a mortgage to purchase a house, why wouldn't they give you a loan to buy this technology and you amortize it over, you know, 20 years or whatever, and then you can afford it, so everybody can afford that technology. I mean, you know, and if you have a house that's on, you know, bedrock, well, maybe you get a special loan because your house is on rock. You know, like, I mean, it's all doable. It's just a question of political will and openness to challenging the powers that be.
Yeah.
And as I say, the thing is that will eventually drive all this is that there's money to be made and plenty of it, and that always is going to, you know, that's where real change happens, is when the economics dictates that it'll happen.
Yeah.
It's funny. I mean, in a way, it's like the way I've heard a quotation, like, the New World Order isn't interested in money. In a way, their plan isn't really they want to impoverish people. That's their intention. They don't
how do
really
they do
want
it? They do it by making lots of money. I mean, you know, I don't agree with that. I mean, in the sense that it's not divorced from money. It's very much about money, because money makes everything run. You know, money.
Well, I would say it's power. They want to have
power,
control.
But these people
are control freaks.
Yeah, but money is power. That's the whole thing.
Well,
if you're going to control information, you need money. If you're going to control people, you need money. I mean,
they already have all the power through the control of money.
Yeah.
Since they manufacture it, their next goal being power through, I believe, enslavement through debt. You know,
enslavement through debt.
Through debt.
Yeah.
Well, debt. DEP. PD.
Yeah.
So, a debt, you know, I mean, basically, for example, if I want to go on a trip and leave, for example, go to Venezuela, I can't, because I have so much bills and so many responsibilities, you know. So that's I believe that that's really what they've done to the general public, is enslave us through debt.
Yeah.
You have,
I mean,
to work.
It's like when you buy a house for $150,000, and you buy it through a bank over 25 years, and you end up paying $500,000 for it. So the bank has made $330,000, and you all the way through struggle, while every month, I remember every month I paid a mortgage of $1,000 on the home. Every month the bank was making $800 to $900 off. I was paying to the bank and paying down my mortgage $100. Like, they just soak up the money from everybody. Imagine if the government helped finance homes and charged 1% interest, you know?
No.
all of a sudden you'd be able to pay your homes off, you know, and buy a $150,000 home for $170,000 instead of $500,000, you know.
Well, what I'll be potentially, you know, during my next campaign, that'll be one of the things I'll be talking to people about is loans for houses, but through the federal government.
Yeah. Oh, really?
You know, your very first loan, very first mortgage, should be mortgaged through the government.
Oh, yeah.
And that would at very low interest, so that people can own their own home.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is that the mortgages are probably the biggest crime being perpetrated on men today. You know, in terms of exactly what you're saying, is like. For example, if you foreclose on a mortgage on a home, the bank takes all the equity and all the money that you put into the house and then sells the house.
Yeah.
So they've just, you know, destroyed the person, but also, you know, made a bundle off of it. So this is, you know, almost favorable for them, especially
yeah.
in Canada where it's all insured on top
yeah.
of it all.
Yeah. Well, that's why during the 30s, you know, in the Depression, bank robbers had a very high status amongst people in the United States, you know.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde and Dillinger, you know, they were great heroes because, you know, banks foreclosed on farmers and ordinary people, but especially on farmers because it's a heavily rural population. Yeah, I always say, you know, when I was younger, the people who charged the kind of interest that... high interest were called loan sharks, and now they're credit card companies, and you know, there used to be people called numbers runners, and now they're called government lottery corporations, you know. Like, I mean, it's only a crime when somebody else is doing it, you know.
And banking was a crime
yeah.
in the
yeah.
1600s.
Well, yeah, well, in Islam, charging interest is, you know, is
yeah,
common,
usury.
Common, usury, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the Bible, too, in the Old Testament. They talk a lot about usury as kind of sinful, and that's kind of what's happened, is these people have taken over our political system because of the usury and the wealth of the banking and the corporate elite. It's terrible what's happened in our society. It's hard to grasp the whole of it. And they've even taken over our education system, so no one's properly educated to understand what's happening. Like, I took economics at university. They never taught you any of the essential things that they don't want you to know.
That's right. They walk out of there, they don't understand how money's created still.
No, exactly.
You know, and how that system really works.
Yeah.
You know, they'll understand that it's like a supply-demand and that sort of idea, but they don't understand where it's coming from.
Yeah, and in basic economics, there was never any mention of any of the issues of the creation of money.
And I think it's funny, even with physics, people don't really understand how even a particle stays together. You know, what is that force that's holding the proton around the electron, you know, and what's holding that together?
Yeah.
Gravity, just like what it's holding on to the planets. But we don't understand that basic.
Yeah, to a certain extent they understand it, like, but then the more you look at, like, it's seen as electromagnetic force, but then there's a question, well, what is that really? And there's new concepts of what that entails. Yeah, even basic things. But I think a lot, they've dumbed people down through the educational system by not allowing the more advanced knowledge to come out. Like, I found my son recently won, the physics prize at his high school, in grade 12 here. And I look at their textbook of what they use for physics. It ends approximately 50 years ago. And all the new concepts which my son would be perfectly capable of understanding and provide a whole new horizon for him, none of that's taught. It kind of ends with quantum theory and relativity theory back in the 1940s, 50s. And that's it.
Presumably they teach that in university.
Even in university, it's limited. The way I see it, and each discipline has been limited. I think certain information has been withheld from people in all areas.
Oh. I don't understand that. I don't agree with that. I mean, it's there. It just, you just have to look for it. But it's like everything else. I mean, there are certain conventional ideas that rule things. And it was like what Michael said about, you know, you take an economics course, but you don't, nobody ever really talks about, you know, well, what is the nature of money, which is like the most fundamental thing. But it's like psychology, it's like anything. I mean, there are all sorts of conventional ideas, but if you look hard enough, I mean, it's just like esotericism. It's not hidden. There's tons of books, you know. There's tons of stuff on the Internet. There's tons of books. There's tons of articles. There's a billion books about the Kennedy assassination. You know, there's thousands of books about the Kennedy assassination. Anybody with a brain can go into any library or bookstore, read this, and know that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill Kennedy. It's not like it's hidden, but people want to be comfortable, and they don't want to be challenged in their ideas or their beliefs about things. I mean, I think it's much more psychological than it is this great conspiracy to make people stupid. People are stupid all on their own, you know, or uncurious and uninterested and don't want to rock the boat and care more about who's on American Idol than, you know, fluoride in their toothpaste and fluorine in their water, you know. It's a matter of priorities. It's like, you get titillated and distracted and, you know, concerned about materialism. And there's a great line in Hayes's book, by the way, about that, Chris, where he talks about, he said something about this, about the decay of civilization due to insatiable materialism versus, you know, the horrors of fundamental religion. Like he says, you know, people are focused on all the horrors of religion, but he says nobody ever talks about the, you know, this insatiable materialism, which I think is, it's like it's psychic. It's like people are raised to be good consumers and not to ask questions. So John Lennon said it best, in my estimation, is, you know, keep you doped with religion and sex and TV, and you think you're so clever and classless and free.
Wow, that's a neat line.
But you're still effing peasants, as far as I can see.
Wow.
You know, there it is.
Wow.
I mean, that's in a nutshell. It's like it's. Like, I mean, there's no doubt that there's manipulation of public opinion and manipulation of information, suppression of inventions. I mean, all these things definitely occur, but you can't kind of discount the power of sleep, of waking sleep. I mean, that's the way I see
it
anyway.
But our viewpoints are very different, Jim. I see it as a conscious, intentional program by a group of people who intentionally did it through their all their institutes and their effecting control over the medical association, psychological, psychiatric. That's how I see it. So we have very different views. Maybe throw it back to Mike and give Mike some time.
Well, I would actually say that this is also like a failing of the education system, you know, and this is in CAPS policies as well, that essentially, you know, what we want to do is change the system so that we can create creative and critical thinkers within our education system.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're teaching a lot of stuff to our kids, but we're not necessarily teaching them the fundamentals so that they themselves can be critical thinkers and perhaps even be geniuses if they if that's what they want to be, you know, because I think we do stifle kids a lot, you know.
See, and so, I see it. I think they've been intentionally fed misinformation. Like I would say, you know, what are the causes of World War II? What was really behind World War II? And we have the standard story we're given through our history and textbooks and the evil of Nazism and Hitler and so on, okay? But they don't teach you the questions of what was underlying that and the finances of it all and the influence and interconnectedness of all that went on under the scenes. You're given the whitewashed version that's intentionally given as propaganda to mislead people so they don't understand what really happened in World War II.
Or
9/11. 9/11.
Which is also, I think, back to the education system. I can't believe that we have so many, you know, engineers, you know. Like, for example, I have a brother-in-law who's an engineer, computer engineer, but all the same, he grasps physics really well and cannot understand how, you know, you know, that how we're being fed a conspiracy theory ourselves that these buildings came down because of these planes. You know,
he doesn't.
I mean, they
that.
Came down in 10 seconds. That's 10 floors per second.
I know.
And to this, to him, this is normal. And you know, I'm having a hard time convincing some of these people. And I think that this it is the education system because these people aren't being
critical thinkers.
Critical thinkers, like I was
yeah.
saying.
You know, I mean, that's like a fantasy story. I always compare it. I always say, oh, people think that Osama bin Laden and his reindeer brought down the towers, because it's as fanciful as the idea of Santa Claus, that those airplanes caused those buildings to come down in that way, in the manner that it happened. It's just absolutely incomprehensible. I mean, even in the second tower, the firefighters stated on the radio signals that there were two isolated fires in the second tower, and they'd almost put the fires out. They were going to manage the fires fine. And everybody reported there were bombs in the building, and it was on the news, and all the firemen said it. It's on the radio things. What more evidence? It's like people can't see reality anymore.
And I don't personally understand why the building would have came down on itself. I mean, to me, I mean, if ever you watch a drop of water, it'll take the path of least resistance. So why straight down onto itself? That's ridiculous. Yep. That building still held the rest of it for the last 100 years. So why would it come down there? Why not to the side?
Yeah, because there are all the explosives all through the building. And then there's overwhelming evidence for it.
Right. Now, there's going to be, by the way, an event, and I do want to sort of plug it
in.
Yeah,
do that, again. Please.
David Ray Griffin is going to be in Ottawa on August 21st. And he's going to be talking all about the physics of how that the buildings came down and how it's been affecting us in terms of policy changes and the loss of our rights on August 21st at the Ottawa Library from 6 to 9. And if people want to reserve tickets, they can do that through me. Mm-hmm. And they email mike.stonge@simpatico.ca. So anyways, quick little plug there. And this is happening right before the CAP convention, which is going to be August 22nd to 24th. And it was sort of just to bring some attention to Ottawa and get some people in Ottawa to get ready for the big CAP convention in 2008. And it's being sponsored, the David Ray Griffin event's being sponsored by the Ottawa Vanier Canadian Action Party Association that I set up just recently.
And you also work with the 9/11 Truth Group in Ottawa.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, you know, a lot of the guys who are the 9/11 Truth Movement and are going out on the 11th of every month are part of our association. Actually, we're the group that we have right now in terms of, like, the president, vice president, and the different chairs in our EDA are very, very, very active people already in Ottawa.
Yeah.
You know, some of the most active people. So for I'm very lucky to have a really good crew on that EDA. So that's why we have the strength really in the sort of, you know, ambition to get this David Ray Griffin event off the ground, because he's coming in from California.
Yeah.
It's a big event.
Hey, Mike, could you just give that address again? Because I just want to write it. I didn't quite get it the first time you said it. It's Mike dot. I didn't get the second part.
It's Saint-Onge, which is S-T-O-N-G-E.
Right.
It's my last name at simpatico.ca.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that for me, like, the thing that changed my mind and really opened me to 9/11 was reading David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor. I was familiar with his work. He's a very prominent theologian and really somebody whose work I really admire, because he mixes philosophy, spirituality, and science, and has a very sophisticated, I think, critique of modern materialist science, and very, very erudite, brilliant guy. And then I saw this book that he had, this book on 9/11. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that's the same guy. And I was really quite shocked, you know, that it was. And then so I read his book, and what I really liked about it was he didn't claim to be telling anybody what happened, but he raised a series of questions which were very disturbing, very shocking, and just said it's clear that to him that on some level the government was complicit, and you can take it from either they let it happen or they actively participated in making it happen. But and then I've read his critique of the 9/11 Commission, which is a wonderful book also. So I definitely will be coming to Ottawa to see him speak.
Great, good.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it.
Highly recommend his work to anybody, especially anybody who's skeptical. Read this guy. He's a very, very, I think convincing in his presentation. I think he's really worth reading. And even if you don't, if you think this is all just conspiracy theory and that people are deluded, I think you have to read his work and really consider what he's saying, because I just think the evidence he presents is overwhelming.
Yeah. And we're really lucky in Ottawa to get him to come down here, actually.
Yeah.
He's coming from California.
Wow.
So people in Ottawa who are willing to come to Ottawa are going to have a chance to see him and talk live.
Yeah.
And hear his most recent thoughts on 9/11.
And he recently was in Montreal, sponsored by the 9/11 Montreal group.
That's right.
And they filled the house, several hundred people there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is this at the library in downtown Ottawa, the Ottawa Public Library, Michael?
That's
is
right, on Metcalf and Laurier.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The
maybe, Jim,
Ottawa.
If you want to stay on 2 days later, the CAP convention.
Yeah, well...
And that's August 21st to 2nd, or 2nd to 3rd?
Well, the 22nd to the 24th. So this is happening a Thursday.
Yeah.
From 6 to 9. Friday is the very first day of our convention.
Oh, yeah.
Hear Connie speak there. If you want to reserve tickets, that's on our... CanadianActionParty.ca website. And then actually shortly after that too, might as well mention it too, is that there's also going to be the March in Ottawa.
Go into that.
What's that?
Were you talking about the march from Montreal to Ottawa? For September 11th of this year, aren't
that? That's right, where everybody's meeting up on Parliament Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be demanding an investigation on 9/11 on that day. So there's a lot of... Go to marchinottawa.org, I believe, or .com.
Marchonottawa.org.
Or Google it, March in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And you'll get a bunch of information on that. So that's also happening in Ottawa. And that's a lot of my guys in my EDA are helping with the organization there, too. So Ottawa's going to be a hub of activity there for this summer.
Wow.
Well, I certainly think anyone trying to speak the truth in these times needs support. You know, when you wake up to what's really happening in our society, it's really quite terrifying. And these people are very brave. Like, I had Mark on from the Ottawa 9/11 group last week, and those are brave young people who go out there. And, you know, like you're saying to the government, you know, this is a criminal government. They've hidden the truth of 9/11 from us, you know. They've sent our soldiers to Afghanistan to fight a war under completely false pretenses. You know, and they've not revealed the truth to Canadian public. This is astonishing. This is terrible.
Yeah, it's very sad.
It's
very
a betrayal of the Canadian people. It's betrayal of Christian principles. It's a betrayal of Judaic principles. You know, it's a terrible thing that's been done. And the media are completely complicit in it. My God, you know, these people, like, they lose their they sell their souls. They lose their souls, these people. They don't understand it. I'm sorry
and
for
I think
them.
All people really have to do is follow their conscience, you know. And if you think something is wrong, it's probably wrong, you know. And what we're doing out in Afghanistan is wrong, you know. And for all the reasons that all the people think it is, you know, it's a combination of all that. It is oil. It is power. It is,
exactly.
You know, for pain and evil. There's so many wrongs within what is happening right now in the world, and people are of course coming to light with it. You know, all sorts of people do understand different things. You know, I'll talk to one girl. She'll say, "Yes, I understand that we're being blocked out on media. I did my thesis on that." But do you understand about 9/11? No, that's a joke. Well, you know, put two and two together here. Is bad and it's evil. Well, maybe you shouldn't put all your money on that, you know.
Yeah.
So
when you wake up, it's unbelievable to watch the media, and you just see right through it. You just see it's a complete fraud. They tell so many lies. They cherry pick. They give you titillation and distraction, misinformation. It's just a complete lie.
That's right. It's actually just one piece of the puzzle, because it's not just media. It's media. It's politicians. And everybody, you know, has no faith in politicians. Nobody has faith in media. Nobody has faith in any of the information that we're getting. I think people are getting real sick and tired of where we are at the moment.
Yeah.
And
I guess that's why that movie
V
was so popular, eh? Where people can't rise up. Like, you know, what do you need on Parliament Hill? 250,000 people? You know, like, when these are people are scoundrels, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We need 250,000 people to surround the RCMP building and demand that they, you know, stop being the Royal Canadian Mounted perverts and stand up to their duties and you know, begin to catch some criminals, you know?
Right. Yeah. Stop using your damn tasers.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they're all the evil things being done within our society to create a police state with police powers that poisoning the people. All these things going on and nothing's done about it. It's terrible. You know, these people, they need their heads examined.
Most other things.
As I call it, the New World Psychiatric Disorder. But CAP, so I'm pleased to hear that you're making efforts to wake people up. The Canadian Action Party, I see, is the only meaningful political party in Canada. I mean, if there was any other candidate in any other area who supported 9/11 truth, I would vote for that party, too. Like, surely there must be someone in the Liberal or Democratic or Conservative parties with some integrity somewhere, isn't there?
Well, it's like actually, yeah, maybe, but they're being shut down because it's like I was asked actually to join the Green Party actually after our February protest.
Mm-hmm.
Green Party said to me, oh, we really like the fact that you're able to mobilize so many young people. We'd like to give you one of our ridings. And I was really sort of surprised. But the thing is that that email also said but that they want me to drop the 9/11 issue.
yeah, of course.
and I was like, okay, so you're sending me into the Green Party. You like me, but you want me to drop 9/11.
Yeah, the truth. That shows the whole structure of the whole thing.
I sat on it for about a week, you know, and in the end, that was my reply, was that unfortunately you want me to drop the big issues.
Yeah.
And that to me is a big issue. It's not, you know, really, it's not the 9/11 isn't the big issue. But what's important is that 9/11 is the gateway to understanding
the
control
that
is being put on us and the lie and all that. So it's not so much 9/11, although that was an atrocity, and that happened on our soil and that we should be fighting for. And we have, like, it's great ammo for the people who understand what's really happening. But I think that's what the 9/11 truth movement is. It's not necessarily just about 9/11. It's about the control. It's about enlightening people because they've kept us in the dark for so long.
Yeah.
Thank God for internet and thank God for YouTube and thank God for all these other things that are bringing us information.
And now they're trying to close that down. It's supposed to begin in Canada by 2010. They're going to have restrictions on the internet and they're
right. I was just going to say net neutrality on the CAP website. We just made a brand new section.
Yeah. I mean, I just see the whole system as having betrayed Canadians. The politicians don't serve the no longer serve the people. You know, they want to have a party at the expense of the citizens of Canada. And they're even willing to allow chemtrail spraying, all these poisons. They're willing to participate in this genocidal plan of the world elites. That's how I see it. They're part of that. You know, I remember seeing Elizabeth May when she became the leader of the party, and there were on the TV there were pictures of her playing golf with Bill Clinton on the golf courses of Nova Scotia. So they're bought out. You know, there is just another one of their. It's like how all the parties are part of the same thing, and they make you think that it's democratic, but they control all the parties. They don't control the CAP.
They always manage to get our politicians, you know. The Green Party was, for a long time, I think, really untouched. They were a bit of a pure party at first.
Yeah.
A little bit like CAP, but not anymore.
Yeah, that's a real shame.
Yeah. Well, their candidates are still real, as far as it goes. Because I've met a lot of Green Party candidates.
Okay, so we are needing to wind up. I'd like, again, to thank Mike St. Ange. Mike, any final comments?
Well, no, I just want to thank you for having me on the show. It was great. Thanks, Jim and Chris. You guys
and we'll have you back, and we'll keep following up the actions of the Canadian Action Party.
Yeah,
good luck to you.
Hope to see you in Ottawa at David Ray Griffin.
Oh, yeah. I'll be at the door.
Okay, great.
Okay, thanks, BBS Radio. Thanks, Jim. We'll pick up on the God theory next week, and we'll see what else.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Goodbye.